Well, I classify myself as a social worker. Incidentally, I'm chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque. And it's one of my obligations under the company law, according to the Articles of Association, I have to look after the interests of the Muslim. And being a Muslim, I'm also obliged to look after the interests of the wider community, because that's part of the religious commitment. So it is in that context that I do whatever I can. Al-Muhajirun and Hizb ut-Tahrir, they are just two sides of the same coin. I think it may be just for strategical reason that they have split into two, but they have got the same ideology, same methodology. And I came into contact with them at the time of Bosnia, when Bosnia was attacked and there was a conflict going on. And I had a meeting here in this hall, which was attended by citizens of this city, mostly non-Muslim, of all kind of persuasion. And what amazed me is that some young people barged into the hall and said, "You are doing this against Islam. You have got non-Muslims in the mosque, and that is forbidden." And I have never come across this opinion before in my life. And I was surprised that these people, who are supposed to be working for Islam, are presenting a picture of Islam, which is absolutely wrong. And it can only be presented if you want to put people away from Islam. From that experience, my perception was that this must be a group of people who intend to present a picture of Islam which is unacceptable to the Western mind. Now, on that premise, I invited them to, because I wanted to know more. That was my perception, but I could have been wrong. I invited them to come and have a discussion. They promised and they never turned up. It happened two or three times, and then I was invited when, what is the name of that gentleman who was the head of Hizb ut-Tahrir at that time, who is now in Beirut, Lebanon. I was once invited to a meeting where Umar Bakri was present. So it was a meeting arranged for me to talk to Umar Bakri, because his juniors did not feel qualified to talk to me. I spoke to him. I had one sitting, and I pointed the error of his opinion. And then there was a second meeting was arranged, and he never turned up.
So what, so, you know, what, isn't it really just a difference of ideology? Surely you're interpreting the Quran in one way, and they're interpreting the Quran in a different way.
The thing is, there is no way they can interpret the Quran the way they are interpreting. That is a problem. Because I have not studied Quran because of an emotional reason. I was an agnostic in my formative years. I have studied because I became convinced that there is a God who has created this, who is the lawgiver. Then it was just a choice to make between Hinduism, Sikhism, Christianity and Islam. It was, to me, it was the same, different sides of the same coin. I opted for Islam because I agreed with it more than anything else. So, having read Quran with that kind of approach, I could not understand how anybody could present this, because this was an emotional presentation of the Quran. And there was no justification. If you are ignorant, then you can sell this story. If you are not ignorant, you couldn't sell it to anybody. And that's what these people were doing. Democracy is forbidden, and non-Muslims should not be allowed in. Now they didn't know them. In Prophet's time, a delegation of Christians came to the mosque, 60 people, headed by an archbishop. They stayed for 1 week in the mosque. They said their prayers in the mosque. And I checked with the Roman Catholic bishop here as to how many prayers were they supposed to perform in a day at that time. And he said about three or five. So that means Muslims were saying their five-time prayer, Christians were saying their prayer at the same time, and as Protestantism was not there at that time, they must have imagery. So they must have been allowed to use their imagery in performing their prayer. So how could any Muslim say that they are forbidden? And there's a whole chapter in the Quran devoted to that incident when these people came and stayed in the Prophet's mosque. So that is why I say there's no way you can present another picture, because it is there in black and white.
So where do you think these people are coming from, the Al-Majarun?
Then I further studied Muhammad Umar Bakri, and what is not well known, at one time he was appointed on the Race Relation Commission Board. And then this news I read myself in the Times, and then suddenly it was removed. There's no trace left of it.
Oh, from the internet?
I have tried, asked people to try to look in the internet when he was, but nobody had come with a finding. So I think this has just been erased. Then, further thinking, who would be interested in creating this picture of Muslim? Unless it is somebody who has already said the rules of the games have changed. So we can tell lies, we can do anything as long as it serves our political purpose. So I concluded as a deduction from that premise that they must have link with organizations or representatives of that political system which is interested in creating this impression amongst non-Muslims.
Because they do seem to have a lot more of a profile in the national press than, yeah, you know, sort of the rate of numbers would suggest. Yeah.
The other thing, I mean, was that they were saying things which, if I said, I would be behind bars or be questioned. But they were having comfortable lives.
What like? What sort, yeah, of things?
Abu Hamza was saying these things, and I was making such a noise that why this person is not being charged under the Terrorism Act. Because once upon a time he said, when there was an attack on an American ship near Aden, he boasted that he got the facts about what is going to happen before it happened. Now, by his own admission, he had links with terrorists. Why the government was not charging him?
Well, now eventually it has.
Eventually. First of all, they charged him under the Immigration Act. Now, they know, as I know, under the Immigration Act, the case can drag on for... I think it was because of the noise I created, because I was talking to MPs, I was talking to leaders of the council, as to why this person is not being... They did charge him under the Terrorism Act. I was still suspicious. I tried to find out what class he was given, what kind of circumstances he was living in. I approached, through a friend of mine, Brian Garish. He wrote to the prison authorities for information about them, and they refused. Then, God bless Daily Mail, it had a story that Abu Hamza was living a comfortable life in prison. He was given a computer costing £1,000, and he had his toenails attended to for £1,500. And I said to myself, that is a good way of treating a terrorist. If you compare it with people who are not with you, say in Guantanamo Bay or in Bagram, they have terrible lives. They are tortured, and if they are women, they are raped. And here this man, who is a terrorist, charged under the terrorist law, convicted under the terrorist law, having a good life. And we are not allowed to see him.
So, as a Muslim, yourself, isn't it really a bit dangerous for you to go criticizing other Muslims?
It is dangerous, not as far as other Muslims are concerned. I think it is dangerous with the secret services. And I say, for example, if Dr. Kelly can disappear under mysterious circumstances, I could disappear too. And there have been 5 incidents in my life. I was invited by a Christian charity to go to Afghanistan to examine their work. And I said, yes, they were going to pay my fare, and I said, okay, I will go, along with the Bishop of Birmingham. And I kept on ringing them, making inquiries, and one day I rang and I was told that the person who was my contact was not free because there was an MI5 officer who was visiting him at that time. Now that made me more suspicious. Then I studied the area where I was supposed to go. That was the most lawless area, where there have been incidents of attacks and people being killed. So I thought it was prudent for me not to go. But I offered them the Imam, who is a Pashtun, and I thought he was better qualified for me, as opposed to me, because he could speak the language of the people, he could understand, he could see their work much better, and he would bring back a better report than I could bring. He was not accepted. He had an interview, but he was dropped out. So that was one suspicious event in my life. Then I had an armed robbery. And the people did not seem to be interested in money or anything. The leader of the gang was on the phone all the time, as if he was giving them time to time picture of what was happening. I was tied up. I had sticky tape around my mouth. I was in my surgery. Then they decided to wheel me in the back room, and I thought that's where they're going to shoot me.
This is at the hospital, was it?
My surgery. What happened that the secretary of my colleague, who was working from my surgery and then moved to another, she was on the premises in the computer room searching for something. They were not aware of her presence. I was not aware of her presence. When she finished her work, she wanted to come into the room, and she saw these people blocking the way. They said, the man who was saying, Garrison, you cannot go. She said, I'm going to come in. So she barged in. Then they, first of all, consulted on the phone what to do. They must have been given advice to lock her up somewhere. They tried to lock up in the toilet. She said, I'm claustrophobic. I'm going to make a hell of a noise if you lock. So then they, on the phone again, she was tied up and taped. Then after another 15 minutes wait, they decided to go. They took my car keys, took my Jeep, and then dropped the Jeep some 60 yards away, and they disappeared. That was one incident. Then when the Lozelles riots happened, there was a clash between Muslims and people from Caribbean origin. I received a call from a very soft-spoken young person whose parents used to be my patients for a point of time. So he said that some of his colleagues wanted to come and talk to me. And I said, fine, you come and talk to me. Come to my surgery. My hours are such and such. He said, no, they cannot come in the daytime. They will like to come at the night time. I said, okay, you come at my surgery at the night. I finished surgery at 7 p.m., and that was winter, it was quite dark. He said, no, they don't want to come to your surgery. They gave me a location where they wanted to see me. I became suspicious. I made inquiries. And that was an isolated house, in very bad repair. And I was advised by my friend that that is not a place that I should go on my own. So when they rang, I said, sorry, I cannot come there, but you come to the mosque. That was month of Ramadan, and there was evening prayer. There was about at least 1 to 1.5 thousand people here at that time. I said, you come there, and I will see you. It's your colleagues. And they said they will come, and they didn't turn up. So that confirmed my suspicion there was something wrong in this connection. A couple of weeks later, he rang me again. He said, we are having a meeting in one of the localities, and we would like you to come. Because of the suspicion in my mind, at the time the meeting was on, I asked a friend of mine to go and see what the situation is. He rang me from his car. He said, there are a lot of young people here, and I would suggest, and they're all of Caribbean origin, and I would advise you not to come here. All I need is somebody to put a knife through me, and you can say, sorry, we can't control everybody. So I did not go. Then the civil police, one day rang me, and they said, we want to see you urgently. I said, what is the matter? And they said, your life is in danger. I said, come along. They came and said, they have intercepted a conversation that chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque was to be eliminated. And they put the panic buttons in my surgery, panic buttons in my residence, call system to get to direct if anything was suspicious. And it was 6 weeks' time, 6 or 8 weeks' time, which I was to be eliminated. I told the police that it's not likely to happen because you people have intercepted the call, and most likely they know that you have intercepted the call, and it is the rule of the game that when you are exposed, you drop the program. But they said, okay, keep all the things as they are. We shall see what happens. So after 6 or 8 weeks, nothing happened, and I'm still alive. But that means, depending on what time, situation can change. At the moment, it seems I'm off the danger, but it can be revived any time. The moment I speak out or something really pinches them, then I think I'll be... One of the factors in my favor is that I'm 84 years old, and they may think, why bother with him? He's going to die anyway. So,
Muslims have been shown to have been involved in some kind of terrorist activity.
Yes, I think one of the ways the secret services work globally is to pick up people and list them under different pretexts. They do not know what the real game is. They are just tools to be used. And one of the classical cases, one person who was an MI5 agent in this country, when he went to Africa, the MI5 or MI6 informed CIA to arrest him, and he was arrested as a terrorist. As I see it, it's very easy. You have got ready information about somebody whom you have already recruited. You know all about him. The moment it happened, you can bring all the details. So-and-so, living in such and such place, doing this and this. And it's that speed which originally alerted me that something fishy here. You know the person, and you have, when the incident happened, you know when the incident is going to happen, and so you bring out all, and the general public thinks that Secret Services have done a marvelous job. One of the reasons that Birmingham is the safest place, that we have done over the year a lot of inter-community cohesion work. So it is difficult for here to sell the story that Muslims are the sources of danger. Because A, we are living amongst them, and a lot of them are mixed areas, and we have been working community cohesion. I mean, this mosque this gets about 10,000 visitors every year. There's a large number of people whom we are talking, and they're not the people who can easily be persuaded that something certainly has happened, that we have turned into monsters. But there have been incidents, and as I said earlier, my suspicion is this is going to flare up again.
Well, why do you say that?
Because there is an urgent need to maintain the perception that Muslims are a source of, and all, as I said earlier, all these anti-terrorism programs are focusing all the time on Muslims. Now that is not going to create, as I said earlier, community cohesion. Quite naturally, it will create fear amongst the communities.
But the government will say that they have evidence that Muslims are committing terrorist acts, therefore they have to do something.
Yes. Now, that evidence we have been asking, if you are so sure you've got evidence, why not have an independent inquiry? Not the type of inquiry you were holding at the time of Dr. Kelly's murder. A truly independent inquiry. Because we are not on opposite sides, we are on the same side. We are against terrorism, you are against terrorism, we want terrorism to be rooted out. But let us remove this suspicion that exists between yourself and ourselves. Let us be joined together on the same side, remove this suspicion by having an open independent inquiry. Why the government doesn't accept it? They are spending millions on this program. They said that they haven't got the money to have, but they are spending millions on this, which is, as I said, is going to be counterproductive. If they are so short of money, I'm willing to say the Muslim community will raise the fund.
How would you convince the police that they don't have to worry about Muslim terrorists, for example?
Police, as you know, cannot talk to us with that frankness, because they have got a departmental obligation. They cannot take sides. They can listen to us, but they cannot take sides. In Birmingham, the relations are very good. They always say, when an arrest takes place, that we were not part of it. And that's very kind of them to say so. And they also say, we came to know only about half an hour before when somebody was going to be arrested. So that means, at least in Birmingham, the civil police is not that much involved as may be in other towns. And you might recall Ian Blair, the Metropolitan Commissioner, soon after 7th of July, visited a Muslim school where he said that Muslims should come out of this state of denial. That was reported on BBC 10 o'clock news on the same day. It didn't show up in any paper. Somebody erased it, or what they call brushed it out. Why? Because he is an officer of the state. He cannot be partisan to against one community or the other. He made that mistake, somebody realized, and brushed out the news.
So do you believe in the jihad?
Jihad is a very wide concept. The word means struggle. In religious terms, that is a common word in Christianity, in all the religions. We are commanded to struggle against our own selves, our weaknesses. So jihad begins with the individual. It is not against anybody else, it is against my own evil self. we are all aware that we have got two voices. A voice that prompts us to do good, another voice that says, ah, that is attractive, go for it. Now, that kind of, in religious terms, that is called, in Islam is called taqwa, being mindful of God all the time. And I think Christianity has got the same. It's called bearing witness to it. So the terms are different, but the idea is the same, that you have to stand witness to the truth and the command that God has given. And the first, you start with your own self. You purify yourself, develop an awareness and a consciousness that there is an evil within that one has to fight all the time. The struggle does not end at any point in time. As long as you live, the struggle goes on. Then when we move out of the personal self, then there's society. There's something wrong in society. There's poverty, there's disease, there's exploitation. So as a believing person, it is my duty, and I think whether you're Christian or a Buddhist or Hindu, we share our ideas in the faith leaders group. I don't think we have any difference of opinion on this. We have to struggle against wrong wherever it is. Now that is jihad. The last part of jihad is the armed struggle. In Islamic ideology or Islamic law, that is not the prerogative of individuals. An individual is forbidden to wage armed struggle. It is the prerogative of a state. And the state has got great responsibility in this regard. There are set rules. The leader of a state has to weigh whether he is in a position to wage a successful armed struggle, to replace a bad order with a good order. And if he cannot do that, he is not obliged to have declare a state of war. Then he must always also be in a position that he will create an order, not a disorder, after having waged a struggle. Now these are the rules of the game. And as I said, no individual can, and there is no difference of opinion in any school of law amongst the Muslim community. And that's what my argument is with Hizb ut-Tahrir and people like that. How can you have individual jihads? And that, I don't think it's well known, because I collected all the Muslim scholars representing every school of thought, and we issued a fatwa, I will give you a copy of, that destroying civilian lives is forbidden in Islam. And we said further that anybody is contemplating, being engaged in this kind of activity, ought to know that this would be against Islamic law. We sent it to everybody, and it was not printed, except the police, civil police here. They were very pleased with that fatwa. They put it on their website.
So this is a situation now where we're seeing some major changes in the financial system here in Britain. The City of London has always been thought to be one great, powerful financial centre in the world, and we're seeing some sort of cracks appearing in the foundations of that. And I just wondered, because I know that in Islam there's quite a strong rules against the charging of interest, how the Islamic take on this current crisis?
I was not interested in economics as I grew up, but it intrigued me. There was one incident in Indian history when a self-made king came. He was by trade, he was a water carrier. In those days, there used to be people who used to carry water in their leather caskets and supply from house to house. That was his trade. But he was a soldier of fortune. He collected some bands and he became a king. And that king, at one point in time, attacked India and defeated everybody. He had nothing to give to his soldiers as a reward. He had his leather caskets. So he cut that into small pieces and said, this is the value of a sovereign. And he distributed that. Now, when I started thinking about economics, that incident in history started coming up in my mind and said, what is the value of money? If leather can be money, a piece of leather, no, which was not had any value, and certainly you give it a value of sovereign. Then it went on rolling in my mind, and I came to the conclusion, money is just notional. It hasn't got a natural value, real value. Anything can be money. A piece of paper can be money. You can say, I promise to bear the bearer to give £5. If you go across the line into France, that promise is invalid. So while I was in this frame of mind, I came across the Christian Union for Monetary Justice in this country. So I went and attended their meeting in London. And I thought, here is our people who would think in the same way as I do. So from that contact, I know that whole monetary system is a deception. This is a fraud being played on the country. Deliberately, we keep on creating scarcity in order to make more money. And there are very few people who make money out of it. And they do not care what happens to the common people. As I study more and more, I think there is a cabal of people in the world who got something wrong with their mind. They are just money hungry and power hungry. They want more power, more. It beats me. What are you going to do with it when everybody is destroyed? But if the common people are destroyed, what are you going to do with all that power and all that money? You travel in one single aeroplane. Why? You're destroying our surroundings. You're bringing about climate change by just using one aeroplane to fly one person from point A to B. You've got 7 houses here. How can you live in 7 houses? This is a kind of a mental illness, I think. And these people seem to be going for more and more power, more and more money. And if you look at who is ruling the world, you come up to the same group of people, Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission, McKinsey & Co., and Common Purpose. And they're all the people who are in one organization, they're also in the other organization, they're also in the third organization. The political leadership is just non-entities. They are picked up, they serve a purpose, and they move on. You keep on changing them for one thing. If people get bored with one, you bring in another one, but they're all singing from the same hymn book. So this monetary system, in my view, is absolutely wrong. It is inhuman. It should be changed. We should have free money supply. The money should be created as it is now being created out of nothing. And it is not my word. It is the word of the governor of Bank of England. Not the present one, the one before. That money is created out of nothing. It is a notional thing. If you are the sole supplier of money, or you have got the franchise for creating money and nobody else can create, then you could create billions on the computer, on a ledger, and as long as people are changing money through you, it works. And you don't allow any other body, unless it's linked with you, to operate the monetary system. Now that means you create an entity, you control it, you can shift it one way or other, as long as it benefits you. It doesn't benefit the people. What we are saying, and I'm saying, the people who are in the monetary justice movement in America and everywhere, they are saying that the money should be created as it is created now, but not on profit. It should be supplied fairly, freely. It should be created according to the need. And one of the pet question that I'm asked is, that will create inflation. And I said, no, the two are not related. You can control inflation by having a department of prices. The price of any product should be based on the cost of production plus a reasonable profit. If you have that department, there's no justification. It's not a divine law that when there is a scarcity, the money, the prices should rise. It is a man's failure. It is greed, because you are really making profit out of people's need, and that is unjust. That's inhuman. So it is very simple. We can change the monetary supply. Parliament should be in charge of creating money. It should be created according to the needs. If you want to build roads, create that much money, it is spent and it's finished. There's no inflation.
What you're saying paints a very reasonable picture of Islam. Do you think in denial about Muslim terrorism?
I am not denying that there could be a person who is off his mind or is mentally disturbed and he does something stupid. Now that can happen, but I do not think that there is any movement in the Muslim community to engage in this kind of activity. I've never heard of Al-Qaeda in my life, and I'm aware of all the Muslim movements in different countries, whether it's Middle East or Indonesia. I've never heard of Al-Qaeda. So who these people are, the only source through which we know these people is CIA. And CIA is not a true witness. About the 7th of July, and the part of the story is not making any sense to me. I'm not aware of any movement among the Muslim community that is geared to that way. And the only people, the Al-Muhajirun and Hizb ut-Tahrir, seem to have a link with the secret services, because they are the untouchables of the Muslim community. When the short period of time in which the people were named and the DNA profile was available was too quick compared with other cases of murder that we see in the country, the information that was made available to public was gathered so quickly, and unless it was predetermined, my mind could not accept it. There are other flaws too, which I came to know later on, because I was only raising questions, but other people have also been raising questions. They may have documentaries and DVDs about this. To give you an example, there was one DVD which is titled Ripple Effect. The one information that I gathered from that DVD, which was not available to me, was that the BBC ran a program a year before it happened, which was exactly the same thing that happened on 7th of July. Now, is it just an incident that people have named places, named determined time, and run the whole story 1 year before it actually happened? Unless there was already a plan in hand that this was going to happen. So the more we look at it, there are more questions that are raised. And the other thing is that the government is using 7th of July to change the British system away from its origins. For example, habeas corpus, Magna Carta, all the principles enshrined in those documents have now been negated under the anti-terrorist legislation. In actual fact, the British state is now moving more towards a totalitarian state than it ever did. When I said it earlier, there were people were saying that I was talking rubbish, Daily Mail wrote an article, David Davis said something that I was wrong. And after this year, Daily Mail put in its front page that we have gone too far. We are going towards becoming a totalitarian state. David Davis has said the same thing, that we are becoming a totalitarian state. So this is what exactly I said. It is not the Muslim community that is so much in danger. It is the majority community which seems to be the real target. It is their liberties, their rights, which are being taken away. And I think this is something which is very dangerous, and people need to be made aware of this.
How do you think the best way to stop that?
The best way to stop it, to create an understanding between Muslims and non-Muslims. Create an awareness that what is being presented is not making sense, and we need an open, independent inquiry. Now, there are different people who are asking for independent inquiry, the relatives of 7th of July, although their angle may be different. Even I think, I am not sure, but there are other, David Davis may be involved in asking for 7th inquiry, I'm not quite sure about that. But there are more people who are asking for independent inquiry, and I think there should need to be a united uproar across the religious divide that we need to sort out these hazy areas, and then we are all on the one side. As long as this suspicion remains that the government is involved in creating an impression amongst the community and the wider community that Muslims are the source of all evil, this is a dangerous situation to be, both for both communities. One community is going to be the target for attacks, and the majority community will be a target for taking the liberties away. So we are all in the same situation. One way or other, we are going to suffer. So that is the reason I beg people to consider this and ask for an open and independent inquiry. We are not going to lose anything by having an open and independent inquiry. We will be more convinced of what the government is saying if it is proved to be true. And if it is not proved to be true, then we have to change the whole of the political leadership. What I'm saying about David Cameron came to the Birmingham Central Mosque. And the moment I mentioned the need for an independent inquiry, he just blew up. He became red in face, thumped his hand on the table, and he said, "That is nonsense." And he was not willing to hear any nonsense. Then I had to say that what you are talking, sir, is nonsense.
So we're not going to get any help.
If the leader of a major party has got that breadth of vision and understanding, I don't think the future looks very rosy.